Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. This episode is from the Momentum Series, resurfacing the most popular episodes from our archives to shine a light on the continued growth of companies in our network. And now, on to the show.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of FinStrat Management. Super excited today because with us we have David Cross, venture partner with Rain Capital. David, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Christian. I've been really excited to connect here and have a conversation.
Likewise. And so with that, let's jump right into it. And if we can start with a little bit of background, we'd love to hear about your journey into venture capital and how you ended up as a partner at Rain.
Sure. That's interesting. I think as I sometimes wonder, like, how does everyone become that? I'm going to say I came up the traditional kind of product engineering path, right? I spent a number of years at Microsoft and Google and Oracle, those type of things. And then there's that moment in your life that you get that first angel opportunity, right? And this is where I was an investor, a seed investor advisor to Twistlock, which is ultimately was acquired by Palo Alto. And from there, that kind of opened up a whole new world for me, right? Is that of, it was a successful exit. I learned a lot about the business, but it was about a little less than a year after the exit of Twistlock to Palo Alto that I was walking down the streets in San Francisco at the RSA conference, and I ran into Dr. Chen-Hsi Wang, right? She was one of the, you know, the chief executives at Twistlock. And she's like, David, I've started a VC. And would you be interested in joining? I said, of course. We got to know each other. And it started right there.
Fantastic. Backgrounds in tech, obviously, yeah. I presume you leverage that for purposes of evaluating opportunities. And so with that, how do you, I'd love to hear your thoughts on investing. So just big picture thesis. And then how do you go about identifying high potential startups?
Sure. I think there's two parts. One is certainly myself, is the super majority of my career has been cybersecurity and security, those type of things. And certainly that was one of the exciting things of what Chen-Hsi Wang has been doing with Rain Capital is focusing on primarily cybersecurity. So that's one, is that not about just being an investor in general, right? It's about being an investor in an area where you have the subject matter expertise, your passion, right? And I think that's a big part of it is not looking at other things, because that's not who we are, right, per se. And so that's a big one. The second one is there's, I think, maybe three elements. One, is it the right area? Two, is there a market? Three, is there an enterprise play? And I think that is so important, right? Certainly in long-term success. Is there an enterprise play, or is this just a smaller, you know, niche play? And that's the big things that I like to always think about when in looking at opportunities. There's more to it, which I'm sure we'll be discussing here shortly.
Okay. So with that, if it sounds like some emphasis on cyber, obviously the world has changed with the introduction of OpenAI's ChatGPT, and it seems like everywhere we look, someone has a brand new that they're looking to sell. And so I would love to hear your thoughts on how you see AI influencing.
Great question. We talked a little bit at the RSA conference on a great panel last year. Is I think there's two elements when I think about security AI. So there's security for AI systems and LLMs, right? So that we need technology, right? We need security technology just like other software for AI and LLMs. That's one. Then there's also AI for security, right? So we actually, where we use AI for our SOC, our DART, our threat intelligence, our vulnerability management. They're two different angles, but they're very distinct ones and very important. And I think that what we're going to see is that, especially on the latter, right, is that everyone could be more productive, more efficient, right, more automated thanks to AI. So I look at it like where we are now, 10, 15 years ago, encryption is a value add. Now you think about storage. Who would ever buy storage without encryption? It's a baseline. So I think in the next few years, we're going to see AI is part of security everywhere.
Makes great sense. Now, this is a little bit in the weeds. And so I'm going to take advantage of the fact that we have you on here because cyber is not in my wheelhouse, but I'm sure we have a lot of listeners like myself who'd love to get your insight on at least one subject in particular that I find really fascinating. Defensive capabilities versus offensive. Seems like most of the time when I read about cyber solutions, it's on the defensive side. I'd love to hear your thoughts on offense.
Absolutely. So I think on the offensive side, certainly there's certainly a lot of fear, right, that of the nation state attackers, crimeware, you know, the type of things are going to take advantage of it. Now, we're saying we're carefully observing the market right now is we haven't seen really any, I say, evidence, right, or cases that are occurring now where that they're using AI to do very complex or compound attacks and zero days. We haven't seen that yet. Not saying it's impossible. We just haven't seen that yet. However, at the same side where we, the same side where we are seeing is very targeted spear phishing, right? Is AI, is they're collecting data and public information to do very targeted spear phishing, right? An email and things like that. And that is occurring. And it's, or we say that it's very clear that AI is helping those attackers in those cases. So I think that's something that we're going to see more of. I think that we're still maybe we're just too early, right? Is that saying that we're going to use AI to find zero days in source code? We just haven't seen quite the evidence of it yet, but we should still be very suspect that it will occur in the future.
So that's super encouraging. And then natural transition, though, is where do you see any reoccurring theme amongst founders and where they see opportunity within cyber?
There is, I think, there's a ton of opportunities. As I think, as first and foremost, I think as we look at great solution today and like, hey, how we can see AI adding to the productivity, adding to the results, those type of things. So I think that's crystal clear. I think that we're going to see a lot of things in the overall, not just the vulnerability management space, but I think as the overall threat intelligence, right? I think there's an element of threat intelligence. Is all threat intelligence the same for every vertical industry, right? Do you need the same thing if you're a Windows laptop shop versus a Linux server environment? It's different, right? I think there's opportunities there for more curated threat intelligence. And it's interesting, I think we've seen some recent kind of acquisitions in the threat intelligence space recently. So I think that's maybe a little bit of foreshadowing or early warning radar in that space. I still think there's another element in the DLP space, the data leak prevention and detection space, right? Is everything's moving to the SaaS world, right? And all applications are becoming SaaS, right? But how to detect the data leakage? And ransomware now is not going so much after encrypting everything. It's more of grab the data, breach, pull it out, and then hold it for extortion, right? So how do you detect that? How do you block that? And I think that's a whole new world.
Definitely investment themes in there. And so when you... So notwithstanding the actual use case that a company is bringing to market, how, when you're looking at deciding whether or not you want to cut a check, how do you look at the founders and their background and their perspective in order to have that play into your decision?
I think there's a number of factors here. Certainly, we never want to say that it's the founders club, right? It's a fraternity. Yep. It's only if you've been at Exit once, then can you possibly be successful. Look, I don't want to go down that path. That's not my thing. But I think there's three things I always like to look at. One is certainly from a founder perspective is the passion there, right? We certainly know the passion, the drive, the dedication, the commitment, right, of the founders, right, is very important, right? The second is do they understand the enterprise, right? Certainly, if you're just going after a small, medium business, let's be honest, right? That market size is much more challenging, right? Compared to an enterprise, you know, market where they're much more a market size and growth. The third thing is it's very important in looking at the founders and a company is their ability to execute. So it's not necessarily just the founders, but it's the team behind it. Is that, do they have the history? Do they have the skills to fully execute? They may have the greatest vision, but we read all the books in history of business, right? It's like, you may have the greatest vision and strategy, but if you don't execute, it's a total failure. And I think that's one of the things that is very important from a due diligence perspective is looking at their ability to execute, their history of the leadership and of that company or that startup, their ability to execute quickly and dynamically.
And so with that, and zero obligation to provide any names, but any portfolio companies that are top of mind that you can think of that were able to navigate any unique challenges and in order to grow the company?
certainly, I think there's a few in it that we know. It certainly is. There's only like simplicity, right? I think has been a great example. Is really is being able to execute very quickly, understanding the needs of the enterprise and making it simple. Plays out to the word a little bit, simplicity, but in vulnerability management, prioritization. Another one I like a lot is Mitiga, right? A lot of people, and I come back to my world of everyone's moving their applications to the cloud and to SaaS, right? But how many organizations really of know how to say, I've got the logging and be preferred for instant response when it's in the cloud versus your own things. And Mitiga is very good in understanding those needs, right? And adapting to it quickly, not just understanding what the tools are, but what is the environment and the skills of the organizations and their needs. And I think that's been a good example as well.
And so one of the trends that we see with FinStrat's clients who are selling to enterprises, regardless of the vertical, is that there's longer sales cycles because there's a more involved purchasing process. What tactics have you seen your portfolio companies employ to mitigate those effects?
Great question. I say there's one of the things I always like to recommend is that I'm going back, putting on my developer hat again is an element, is that you want to try something on the web, you want to download a package. Does it compile in a few minutes and just work the first time or not? So let's think about it as a startup, is that are you going to have a complex legal agreement for someone to do a proof of concept or a trial? Or do you do something in such a way saying, give me your Gmail account, sign up with your personal Gmail account and try it out. Away you go. In 5 minutes, you can test it, you can feel it, no obligation whatsoever. And you can name some various startups, not necessarily in that have done this. And it becomes a naturally viral, right? If you make it complex, the sale is going to be complex. You make it easy, people get addicted very easy. Now, I've got some gray hairs. I'll go back. Let's go back to way back in the late 90s, in where Microsoft and Windows NT 4.0 and Internet Information Server, right? Just put it under the desk and it took off, right? Or do you make it complex and hard to get in? Just make it just there. It just works in 5 minutes and then people, it goes viral.
Yeah, I think 100% agreed. Ultimately, if you think about it, we would unpack it. We're talking about how do we modify people's behavior. And you know, one of the ways to think about it is depending on the incentive that they have, the more easy we can make something, the more likely they are to adopt the tasks that we'd like them to do. So, but that brings up a great segue. So you have a wealth of information. To what extent do you normally or personally get involved with providing your portfolio company's guidance?
Great question. I think this is where I think for a lot of VCs, where your venture partners and others, right, you want a different set of skills and experiences, right? Say you want diversity, right? What I mean by that is certainly, I think as our founder, Chen Xi Wang, myself, we're very different, right? And sometimes a startup has different needs. Sometimes they may not understand the CISO persona. They may not understand the enterprise. And certainly we can think some of the Israeli startups and others is that, do they have the same experience in messaging and marketing, right? In North America and how to do that. And so sometimes it's all based on where their potential gaps are and how you can complement and filling that where needed. Now, at the same time, I should come back, you know, Christian, to an element of successful startups and making a choice is that, are they open to feedback? Are they open to help? Because sometimes if they're not, then that's maybe a completely different bet, right? In itself, that when things go wrong, they're not going to take advice and assistance. Maybe it's not maybe it's too risky of a bet to make sometimes.
It'd be fun to unpack that. You're about obtuse founders who are successful because they're hard-headed. But maybe as a study exists and it's out there, but that would be interesting to know whether or not someone who has a more open mindset has a greater probability of being successful. Because it's difficult to argue. I don't know of anyone who has all the answers. Mm-hmm. And if you can surround yourself with great counselors, arguably you have an advantage. Mm-hmm. And so with that, let me, notwithstanding being hard-headed, are there any mistakes or that you consistently see amongst early stage companies, pitfalls that you'd encourage other founders to be aware of to avoid?
Certainly, I think as you know, closing on the previous one, the element, it's, I think as you and I agree, is hey, hard-headed, sometimes that's great. It's the passion, right? But it doesn't take away from the ability to ask for help. And those that ask for help, where they know they need help, great. That's a big one. I think one of the challenges is not going to elements, as we know the world changes quickly and dynamic, but it's really when you don't make the changes in execution when you've been notified by multiple people that you're not executing, is that sometimes you can hear it once and that's one voice, but hear it two times or three times, then it's total danger, right? Three strikes, you're out, or warning Will Robinson.
In your experience, what do you attribute the inflexibility to?
I think sometimes it may be one person in the startup, like they were there for the early days and great, they helped to get to that stage. But as we've seen from various books, like the startup, I think it's the book called The Startup CXO, right? It's like, you may hire someone at the very start when five people, they're the chief marketing officer, but now you're 200 people. Are they really still ready to be the chief marketing officer for that next stage? And it's hard sometimes as founders, it's hard as early employees in it, is saying that they're not the right person anymore, and you have to let them go and make a change. And I think sometimes that's a trap, as quicksand, you would say, that people don't get out of.
I've seen that. I think your assessment is spot on. And what probably makes it more challenging is there's no explicit roadmap that says, hey, you're at milestone C, time to adopt a different mentality. And so with that, as far as milestones go, one of the big ones for many early stage companies is financing and reaching out to venture capital firms. I'd love to hear your perspective from the VC. And then also, what advice would you give to founders who are interested in raising capital for the first time?
Well, what advice can I say? I can say that, yes, for many of us, right, we get, I'm lucky if I only get one request a day to saying, hey, will you please look at us? Yeah, at the same time, I could say for me personally, is an element is like, you send me the deck as the pre-read opening versus get on a call, right? Is I say, be proactive. If you really have something that good and you'll send me the deck right up front and it's that good, I'm going to want to talk to you. But those, right, you could say, oh, that's not how you fish. That's not how you're going to hook the fish. I don't buy that. It's when you're competing, right? How do you differentiate, right? How do you make it successful? The other element is I can go back and use another analogy. When you're trying to break into the market with your first job, right? You want to go to company X, but you don't know how to get in. You just find someone saying, hey, I'll send you a $25 gift card, right? Or Starbucks gift card. Can you spend me 5 minutes so I can learn about your company and how I might be able to get in there? Be creative, right? Saying, I'm not going to give someone a $100 Uber certificate or something like that to talk to me for 5 minutes, but maybe it might be worth it to do that, right? Because it's the art of influence, the art of reciprocity, the vacuum cleaner salesperson. Why did they give the lady of the house, you know, in the 1950s, a bundle of flowers, right? Because they know she'll be reciprocal and speak to them. Because sometimes as a startup, you have to think about how do you influence and create that feeling and need of reciprocity to get your foot in the door.
You know, it's interesting. You think about founders, I'd argue at heart, are creative, but I don't know why, but generally speaking, I don't think they think to apply their creativity to engaging relationships. But I also think it's valuable. I think a lot of times founders who've not worked at a VC firm really appreciate the volume of outreach that you're receiving in any given day, let alone the scope of responsibilities that you're asked to fulfill. And so with that, let me ask, are there any telltale signs, red, green flags that you look for when someone does make a connection with you?
I think the red flag is always when, I'll go back to my days of Google, right? Be data-driven. If there's no data, red flag, right? Is if you'd say, oh, it's secret. Oh, we're behind the scenes. Oh, we know what we're doing, right? Red flag, right? If you can't be open and transparent, open the kimono, no chance.
Yeah, I think it's a great point. And for the founders in the audience, I don't know. My sense is that they don't always appreciate that venture capitalists have clients of their own. They're their investors. And they have a fiduciary responsibility to conduct due diligence on a company before they invest. And like all relationships, as you point out, not only there's a reciprocity, but there has to be trust. And being able to bring a degree of transparency, I think is, in my experience, is essential.
I think I'd add one thing is there's an element is you could say, sometimes you say that various VCs, they're all competitors. I think is why you and I are talking today is you never know, the network is always connected and so it can be a partner. You never know when the VC you may be competing with, right? Actually, you may be your joint, you know, partner, right? In another investment. And so there's a lot of connections. The minute you throw the grenades and burn bridges, right? be careful, right? You never know when that may haunt you later.
A lot of value in adhering to the golden rule. And if you decide not to, I'd encourage you to have a really good reason. And so with that, a lot of things remain the same, but things also change. When you look at the horizon, how do you see the VC landscape staying the same or changing?
That's a really good question. One of the things that I've been really pining about quite a bit is there's a lot of everybody wants to be a unicorn, of course, right? Everyone wants unicorns at VCs. You want unicorns, of course. But how many unicorns can survive on this planet? Now, where am I going with this? I think there's a ton of opportunities that you think about of smaller companies. That $20 to $50 million is that some people call it the aqua hire, but right, is like a founder can come in, or founders can come in 18 months, take a couple million, where they can then become very off, right? Very low impact, very short period of time. And the VC from a seed is, it's a 10X, right? In 18 months, right? But a lot of people are hanging on so much to the pride on being a unicorn versus take the short win, take the sprint and win, right? And I think there's a lot of opportunities out there in the future, especially as we're looking at the other challenges with the market and the economy for people to consider this.
And on that note, I'd be curious, is having a conversation on return something that you either A, find that founders lead with, hey, David, I'm looking for a double versus a home run. And if not, how often do you find that you'll make a point of putting that on the agenda if you find a company that you like?
I think that it's especially, I think, in the first time of founders is that they want to be that unicorn, that home run, the grand slam from day one, when they've never been in that space before, versus saying that maybe it's great to just get a single, get on base or hit the double and things like, and then eventually you could get to that grand scram. But the thing is, do you go for that for your first time at bat?
The founders who are listening, I mean, I really think this is a great piece of advice, is really think about, you understand what your market is, and you also understand how your solution fits in there. And it's totally fine if you get a single, double out of a company. Because the flip side is, you point out, maybe you're looking for a home run, but not realizing that your solution isn't gonna conform to what the market's ready to put a unicorn valuation on. And you may end up finding that even that single or double may be a swing and a miss because of the amount of time it's going to take you to find out it doesn't materialize. Great conversation. Before we wrap up, last question, what piece of advice would you give your younger self when you first got into venture capital investing?
The best piece of advice, the best piece of advice I got is when I started from the very beginning, as soon as you get in venture capital, assume you're always going to lose. And it's going to Las Vegas. You put the money on the table, assume you're going to lose. And if you put the passion behind it and you hit it, you're going to feel great. But never expect that you're going to hit the blackjack the moment you put your first money on the table.
And with that, David, thank you very much. I very much enjoyed this. Really appreciate you sharing your experience and your perspective. My sense is the audience is very fortunate, a whole host of great wisdom in there. With that, David, how can, if someone wants to get a hold of you, where can they find you?
Yeah, you can find us on our LinkedIn, of course, and certainly our raincapital.vc, website. We'd love to connect with people. And Christian, it's been great connecting with you as well. So I hope we can work together on maybe something interesting in the near future.
Likewise. David Cross, venture partner, Rain Capital. Again, I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Fincher Management. Thank you for listening to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. If you're a successful founder or an investor, would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com/podcast-guest. If you've got something out of this interview, please share this episode on social media. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovators and Investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. Would you like to know more? Go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is @finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.